court reversibly erred when it upheld the legality of the second of two consecutive alleged inventory searches, and for at least four reasons, we are suggesting to the court that the district court did in fact reversibly err. Running through those very quickly, the second search, which is the search at issue, the search that yielded the finding of a firearm, was not authorized by the Dallas Police Department policy that governs inventory searches. Secondly, the impetus for that second search was the second officer's own personal declaration that this was his standard procedure to do a second look. That would be at, I'll give you the citations later, but for now, record 160. The district court's findings, the third reason, the district court's findings and conclusions are based on legal error. They are relying on the officer's training to the exclusion of what the actual standard procedures are. And then finally, the record evidence does suggest, not necessarily prove, but suggest, which is what the legal standard is, that these inventory searches, and certainly the second one, were used as investigatory searches. Just briefly looking at the log in, the court is well aware that the purpose behind the inventory search is threefold. The notion of categorizing property, insulating law enforcement from claims that there was theft, and then protecting law enforcement. Some might note that after Arizona versus Gantt was handed down, which of course restricted the uses of search incidents to arrest, the number of inventory searches, at least in the division where I am, the district where I am, increased markedly. In any event, the difference between the search incident to arrest and the inventory search is that the latter must be done in accordance with written policy, standard policies. The closer that law enforcement hews or tacks to that type policy, the more likely the search is going to be found by reviewing courts to be within the ambit of the inventory search.
Well, you don't deny that the police department had the authority to impound the vehicle here.
Absolutely.
And the defendant turned down the opportunity to turn the vehicle over to his friend or cousin or whoever that female was on the scene.
That's true. But it's not dispositive of the issue here. The closer, as I was saying, the closer that law enforcement tacks, the more likely the search is going to be legal. The trial court's order here, memorandum opinion, points out time after time that these officers did not adhere to the stated policy. The district court itself noted that they were entitled to one search. There were two, and there were all sorts of administrative oversights, if not violations, throughout. And that's, I don't think, question. Now, I mention this because the second reason that we talked about, this notion that the second officer admitted at page 160 that he was looking, he went ahead and did a second search because that was his own personal standard. But the reason that we have, and the reason that police departments, the reason the Supreme Court requires that there be an objective policy that's written out that everyone strives for, is precisely to avoid the imposition of this freelancing quality.
The district court didn't find this emphasis on a rogue search that you are making now.
No, as a matter of fact, and this will, I'll move to the third point here momentarily, the district court looked at, obviously listened to the testimony, and then in its analysis said, among other things, finding the officers credible.
How strictly must the officers follow procedure? Can there be a minor deviation? I think that's what we have here, is at least that's what it's called, some sort of deviation. Do they have to cross their T's and dot their I's? And if you don't do it exactly how it says, too bad. I mean, can there be some deviation?
Obviously, there can be deviation, and I think it's fairly clear in the law that there is no bright line. Rarely are there bright lines. What is interesting about this case is that the law doesn't, that we've been able to find, doesn't speak in terms of two searches or three or four or five. In this case, it speaks in terms of one. And in the cases that we've cited in briefs, and we can talk about them, but in general, we have a situation where there is a search. Here, of course, what's novel is there are subsequent searches. And I don't think that it does any injustice here to keep in mind that what the uncontroverted evidence was here and what the district court's order points out is that the first arriving officer, the officer that pulled over our client, said that he observed suspicious gestures, furtive gestures, I believe is what the record says, and that they were directed toward the center of the car. And then, of course, he went and looked, and he, by his own admission, he did the first inventory search, found nothing, and then they proceeded on their way to jail.
Did he have any discussion with the second officer and said, I saw him make some gesture, you might want to go in there and look for a gun?
They spoke, but it's not manifest or it's not explicit as to what exactly they spoke about, although it is interesting that the second officer very candidly, and the district court said credibly, went directly to the same area of the car where the furtive gestures had arisen and did, in fact, he said, I moved the seats and didn't just look inside the car, but actually began to delve in between the seats and what have you, and then discovered.
Well, I don't know about you, but the place I'm most likely to drop my wallet or my iPhone or my comb or my lipstick is between the seats. And I don't carry a gun in my car, but I mean, that's where the driver and the principal passenger in a car tend to secrete things or drop them. And for inventory purposes, those tend to be the more valuable things.
That may in fact be the case.
That's just human nature, it seems to me, in driving.
Well, I think the point and the touchstone, of course, is that the policy allows a search, and a search was performed, and nothing was found. The fact that all of the circumstances you've described, I'm not suggesting that's not human nature. I am suggesting that it's legally irrelevant.
I thought the first officer explained that he was securing Mr. Shaw to arrest him, and he was preoccupied with that, and this other fellow came up as, the backup to impound the vehicle.
No, that I believe that what the testimony shows is that the Mr. Shaw was whisked away to the back of the patrol car, and then Officer Torres went back and performed his search, and he has said
as much. The first officer testified that he was conducting a search incident to arrest, and he was looking for contraband drugs.
Well, yes, he did, and I think the citation to page 150.
And then he got pulled off, and the second officer came in and did a more thorough search.
Well, what the record shows, first, as the first part of your observation, Judge Higginbotham, the Officer Torres did in fact say at page 154 that the gravamen, the purpose behind these searches, were to look for valuables and drugs and weapons and contraband. All right, he said that. He also said at different places that he did, in fact, perform an inventory search.
Well, he wrote on his police report that it was a search incident to arrest.
He did, and then he corrected himself, because had this been an actual search incident to arrest, then I don't think we'd be here today, because I think...
In that context that you asked the question, which to me is the question, is whether or not the second search was really an effort to shore up the earlier one or with a true inventory search.
Well, I know that the record says that...
Fitzwater found that it was not, actually.
Well, speaking first to what the evidence was, then moving to the district court's order, Officer Torres, in a number of places, said he had done an inventory search. And you're correct. Initially, he said search incident to arrest, and then very understandably switched that out. As to the district court's finding, the district court also found that there were two searches.
But it wouldn't matter. The government doesn't rely on that first search.
Right.
Its evidentiary value, if any, as it bears on the question of the validity of the second search.
Yes, that's true.
And why isn't it enough for Judge Fitzwater's finding erroneous? He had this evidence before him. He's concluded that the second search was an inventory search, essentially.
The district court below concluded that there were two searches, that neither of them adhered to policy, to the Dallas policy. He erroneously found, and I very rarely do you ever hear me talk about clear error, because this is not my first rodeo, but in his order he says that the second officer did not know that the first officer had searched, but in fact at page 168 the second officer does say, established that he did in fact know that there had been an earlier search. The district court, in its order, what it was doing that I think is legal error, is it was relying on training. This notion, the district court kept saying, well, the second officer's training was such that he took the actions that he did. And what I would suggest to you, training is the process by which one ideally accomplishes that which is set out in standard procedures. The idea being, if you're trained properly and if you're acting in accordance with proper training, then at least in the abstract or ideally, you're going to accomplish those objectives that are set out in the standard procedures. The fact, because oftentimes people have deficient training, and I can give any number of real world examples of this, where particular procedures are not met or adhered to because of deficient training. Where the district court erred is by saying repeatedly, and I'm referring now to pages 16, 17, and 18 of the order itself, that because the second officer testified credibly that he'd been trained a certain way, that it somehow basically substituted, if you will.
Was his training unconstitutional?
Well, to the extent that yes, absolutely. The training indirectly would have to be, because if his training says that he can do more than one search, and if the policy says you can do but a search, and if the Supreme Court has said you must do this in accordance with
policy. You know what? I don't think the Supreme Court said one search.
Well, I think if the Supreme Court says it must be done in accordance with policy, and if in this particular case policy says a search, then when we connect the dots, whether directly or indirectly, that's where we end. You asked if I think it was unconstitutional, and I'll stand on the answer yes.
Has this court ever upheld a search that deviated from the Senate operating procedures, an inventory search?
Oh, yes, and so now this goes back to Judge Prado's earlier observation, is where is there a line? And of course, there's not a line. It's a matter of degree, and I think what's remarkable here is we have two searches, not just a search. And if the court, when the panel reviews the court's law and looks at what the, up until now, the typical case has been, it's involved a search where perhaps something was found and in the inventory process went awry or
skewed. Why does it matter that there was a second search, except that it may imply that the second search was not an inventory search,
which
is a continuation of that?
Well, yes, because
the... You have a factual finding to the contrary.
Well, because the... Well, yes, we have factual findings, but to the extent that they're based on an erroneous legal a misunderstanding of the law, then I don't think they're entitled to any deference. But to go back to your specific question, the problem, of course, here is the second search. That's the search that harvested the gun, if you will, and that's the search that was not permitted expressly by the policy. And that goes to the fourth point, and I'll spend the next couple of minutes on this, and that is this record does actually evince the suggestion that the search, in this case the second search, was motivated by investigatory purpose.
So what's supposed to happen in a case? Just assume arguendo that the second search should never have been conducted, and the gun stays there, and it goes to the impoundment yard, and Mr. Shaw pays whatever his outstanding traffic ticket was and gets out, and then he gets his car back, and then he calls and he says, "Where's my gun?"
Well, I don't know exactly, in terms of the hypothetical, I don't know that Mr. Shaw, if he were so fortunate, would be calling and asking about that, but I don't have a specific answer, other than to simply say that in this record, the second search officer pointed out that oftentimes things that should have been found and aren't found are left in cars, left in impoundment.
This court relied upon some of the pointed decided case law of other circuits, including the Eighth, which had the formulation, and I have it here in front of me, that the inventory failure to comply with the SOPs does not necessarily mandate the suppression of evidence unless, quote, there is something else, something to suggest the police raise the inventory search banner in an after-the-fact attempt to justify a simple investigatory search for incriminating evidence.
Yes.
Now, that was the law that Judge Fitzwater applied, and he said he just didn't see sufficient evidence that there was something else. But the something else that sort of standing pretty large is that there's a second search, which also proceeded right on the scene and went right at the heart of whether you would, you know, where the gun was.
Now,
that seems to me where the case lies, or
Well, I think if the court will focus on the district court's order, in fact, those things that were that the record uncontrovertibly gives rise to the suggestion of the investigatory function are not mentioned explicitly in the order for that purpose. My time has...
Yeah, I know your time's up. Let me just ask you, was there, am I mistaken, was there something in the testimony that where the second officer said he wasn't sure if the first search had been completed?
At one point he said that. He initially equivocated and said, the question was, you know, do you know, can you say for a fact that the first search already said, I don't know for sure. And then later at page, I'll check the sites and confirm them, but I think at 168 it becomes obvious. And he in fact says, okay, I knew that he had taken an earlier look, that the first officer had been in the car and taken an earlier look. So the second officer knew. And the record, I mean, the record is the record. We're very comfortable with this record. Thank you.
All right, you have time for rebuttal. Mr. McKay.
Mr. McKay, if it, picking up on that line of art, colloquy, that suggests that the first officer was conducting a search and then there was a handoff to a second officer. And the government says that the second search, the first search concededly invalid. The officer himself said he was searching incident to arrest and fill out the report. So how do if it's a handoff of an incomplete search, in other words, he didn't get through with it, but he hands it off to finish it, how do you defend that?
Yes, Judge Higginbotham. May it please the court, Brian McKay on behalf of the United States. I would address that by saying a couple of things. First of all, I don't think there is a concession nor a recognition or finding by the district court that first search was invalid, that it was a search incident to arrest.
I didn't thought the government was defending the first search here.
I don't think we're defending it as an inventory search, but I don't think that it's relevant. As the court pointed out during Mr. Beard's time.
Well, do you maintain that the first search was valid when the officer conducts it on the scene and fills out a report that says that this was incident to the arrest?
I think that what he did is he described Officer Trahan, Detective Torres being the first officer, Officer Trahan being the second officer. I believe that he described Officer Trahan as doing a search incident to arrest. And then at the hearing, he said, I was incorrect in my description of that. He certainly didn't describe, my recollection of the record, if I'm mistaken, I'm sure the court will correct me, but I don't believe he described his own search as a search incident to arrest. In fact, I recall him saying both of the searches that day were inventory searches. He said that he had begun the process once he saw Officer Trahan in the distance approaching as a backup. That's when he left the arrested person at the car, at the patrol car, and went into Mr. Shaw's car to begin the inventory process. Once Officer Trahan arrived on the scene and agreed to...
Let me pick you back up on that. The officer later testified he was searching the area that would have been within Shaw's reach, although he was already handcuffed in the squad car, to make sure there were no weapons or contraband left in the vehicle. Now, that's the usual justification for a search incident to arrest. That was his later testimony, not...
Had the district court made that finding that that was a search incident to arrest, I wouldn't be here arguing that the court had clearly erred or that that finding was clearly erroneous. I wouldn't make that argument. The district court, however, did not make that finding, and that finding wasn't necessary, whether it was a valid inventory search or whether it was a search incident to arrest, whether it was motivated by finding evidence, is immaterial to, entirely immaterial, but it's not necessary to the determination of what Officer Trahan was doing.
Do you agree with that the operating principle is that deviations from an SOP are permissible, not a hyper-technical type
yeah.
of analysis, provided there's not something else to suggest that the second search was really a search for contraband and not in fact an inventory search?
Yes.
Okay.
I believe
if that's the principle, then my question simply is, why isn't the first search that which here is I think plainly flawed, there's something else that it
well, because there's no evidence whatsoever that even if we assume that it was flawed, that it was a search incident to arrest, that it infected or tainted in any way Officer Trahan's performance of the inventory. Judge Prado had asked about whether Detective Torres somehow conveyed information to Officer Trahan. I'd submit that on this record there is no evidence of that. Mr. Beard pointed out that Detective Torres, when he first stopped the car, he saw furtive movements inside, and I will make it even better than that and point out that Detective Torres, excuse me, even stated that upon contacting Mr. Shaw, he smelled marijuana, and those things may have contributed some sort of or created some sort of suspicion with Detective Torres, but by the time Mr. Shaw was in custody on warrants and Officer Trahan arrived, there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever on this record that Detective Torres passed those facts on to Detective Trahan and said to him, well, when you get into the car, be looking because I saw him moving.
Just tell me what happened. Officer one conducts a search, and does he leave the scene, and then the second officer come on, or tell me just what happened in that sequence.
No, Detective Torres said that once he had made the decision to arrest and had Mr. Shaw at the car, he was not going to begin the inventory, although he was a two-person unit. He wasn't going to start the inventory because there were two subjects on the scene. He wasn't going to start that process until he had backup. And once he saw Officer Trahan and his partner in the distance on the way to provide backup, that's when he got into the car and began the inventory search, looking around the car, the console, and that area.
Was that begun after the female passenger had declined to take possession of the car?
I believe that's correct. That
because they wouldn't have had any reason to do it at all unless if the friend was going to take the car.
Yeah, that's what
precise.
I think that's an important fact. Let's be clear about that.
Yes.
Does the government agree, concede that procedure was not followed here according to the police department's process for an inventory search?
No, not at all. In fact,
so there was no deviation? They did the way they're supposed to do it?
I don't believe so. Now, there has been discussion, the district court did find or conclude or find, however you want to look at it, that the policy provides for one inventory search by using the word an inventory search. But here, and Mr. Beard had alluded to, called attention to the fact that Officer Trahan said this was his personal practice, but I would submit to you, pointing to page 51 of the record, the policy itself says that in all cases where a vehicle is to be impounded, it will be searched by the impounding officer at the scene.
Go back to this fact question, this question, the sequence of event. Earlier, Judge Jones asked the question about the offer to, which would perhaps reject, I gather was rejected, by the female. Did that happen? It would seem to have happened before you conducted a second search, but I want to be clear about that. In other words, is it the situation that you had the arresting officer, he did a search and so forth, and then he offered to give the vehicle to the female passenger and she declined it, and then the second officer comes with that, now they're going to have to impound the car. So now I'm trying to understand what the sequence of that.
I don't think there is a clear Q&A that says, did you ask before you looked into the car? I don't think that clear Q&A is there. What I do recall from the record is that detective...
But it's very, very different if after you've already searched and gotten the gun and so forth, you then offer to give the car to her and she won't take it.
That's correct. If that search had actually yielded the gun, yes. But what Detective Torres did testify to...
It's clear one way or the other on that. That's what I'm trying to understand.
What Detective Torres did testify to was that he asked for permission, or he asked if Mr. Shaw wanted to release the car to his cousin. He declined, and at that point, it became necessary to do an inventory. And he said that what he did was actually an inventory. I think on the standard of review applied to this case, the court would...
So you're saying that before you conducted the search that found the gun, they had offered to give the vehicle to her. Is
yes.
that correct?
Okay. Yes.
And she declined it.
Well, it wasn't her. It was him. He was the one that declined it.
Chief, whatever.
Yeah. Right. Yes. So at that point, it became necessary to do the inventory.
So who was the impounding officer in this case? Was it the officer who arrested, or was it the second officer who was there with the car when the tow truck, I guess, came and picked up the car?
It was the second officer. When Officer Trahan came onto the scene, offered to Detective Torres to oversee the impound, and Investigator Torres accepted that offer, Mr. Trahan became the impounding officer. And whether it was something that he viewed as something, his personal practice, unwavering personal practice, not something that was a matter of discretion that was motivated by an intent to look into the car for evidence, even if that was the case, it wasn't just his personal practice. It was actually required by policy that he was the person. He was the person responsible for doing the inventory, accounting for the belonging inside. Now, the district court heard all of the evidence, and it made the factual finding that what Officer Trahan was doing was motivated by an intent to prepare an inventory and not rummaging through the car looking for evidence. And in his brief, although Mr. Shaw seems to concede that factual finding is adequately supported by the record and can't be reversed on plain error, it seems that that's precisely, in this particular case, what he's trying to do and what he has to do to obtain reversal. There's no dispute whatsoever that Dallas Police Department has an inventory procedure, and that animates or carries out the purposes of the inventory search doctrine, so that the issue is whether officers acted pursuant to that policy when they found the gun.
So was the first search improper? It didn't find anything, but was it a proper search?
I believe that on this record, there's the district court could have found either way. I don't think it made a finding, except to say implicitly found that it was an inventory search, because he said it allowed for one inventory search, and the district court concluded that they conducted two. So I think implicitly the district court made the finding that Detective Torres was attempting to conduct an inventory when he began to look into the car.
Well, if you really want to get hyper, hyper, hyper technical, you could say that Officer Torres was the impounding officer until backup arrived, and the policy says the impounding officer, blah, 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 and therefore they were each impounding officers. But I really don't think the law ought to operate on that basis. That ought to be some common sense.
And
if there's no improper motive.
And Judge Jones, you're not alone in that. As the Supreme Court itself has recognized, that this is not a mechanical all or nothing issue. There is no, if you allow me to use the term, there's no strict liability for officers in this, that they have to adhere perfectly to the procedure or else the search is invalid. In fact, and I think what, if there's an opportunity for the court to provide clarification or...
Yes and no. The SOPs are, in this context, are critical to the validity of the search, because there is no other justification for bypassing the Fourth Amendment. Now, that's the only basis for searching the car. And the court, and part of the law that the Supreme Court gave us was that they needed these standard operating procedures. Now, the procedures, so that is a very bedrock principle. Now, they shouldn't be read in a hyper-technical manner, but nor, on the other hand, should we be, I'm not suggesting this, how that operates here, but I don't really think that you're going to find any cases from our court or any other court where there have been any material deviations from standing operating procedure that upheld
the good faith Leon doctrine apply?
I don't know. I mean, this wasn't, speaking to Leon, this wasn't a warranted, you know, good faith reliance on a warrant.
That doesn't matter.
But here, I would point the court to its decision in Gallo. Previously, Judge Higginbotham had asked about whether, you know, one search, two search, whether a second search renders the matter invalid. There were two searches. As a matter of fact, one search conducted by Houston.
Nothing automatic. I'm not suggesting anything automatic about that. I'm just suggesting that what I said was that the fact of a second search in this context is evidence that bears on the question, which I think is a critical question here, of whether or not this was, in fact, an inventory search or whether it was incident to arrest itself. And what that tells you, and the problem in the first search for you, the government, is that the arresting officer thought he was conducting an inventory search. At least that's what he said he would do. And so that whatever he might have done, he thought it was incident to arrest, and that's what he called it and so forth. And then you have a second search, right?
And if I may, with that clarification, I understand what the court now is saying, and I would point out, as Judge Higginbotham, as you said, as a matter of fact, that is relevant. And if we look at the several decisions where there was an actual deviation from policy, and in particular I'm pointing to Cartwright, Garreau, Hockenberry, Mayfield, and Mundy, all of those are out-of-circuit opinions, but there, where there was actual deviation from the policy, but a factual finding that
officer... It may be hypothetical, but to me, I think the very large fact here, that's why I push you on it to clarify it, if the officer here, if it's the case that the officer said offered to give the possession of this vehicle to someone else, and only when that was declined did the second search go forward with, that's very powerful evidence that the second was inventory. I hope you agree with that.
I do. And that was actually done before the first search was even conducted. So the issue was the second search, and I think Judge Fitzwater, correctly apprehended the question of, is there this second search? Was it done because Officer Trahan was looking for evidence of criminal activity, and did he just paper it up as an inventory search? And under the facts of this case, because Officer Trahan became the inventorying officer, because he didn't know anything other than the fact that Detective Torres looked into the car, he thought that he interrupted the inventory, but he knew there wasn't a completed inventory sheet, and he was responsible for doing that.
You're always looking for criminal evidence, even an inventory search. The inventory search justification for doing this is just to account for what's in the vehicle. And of course, they love to find something incriminating too. So, just because they would like to find something incriminating does not invalidate it. If the purpose and motivation of this is the accountability of the police department, the necessity of the police department having to account for the contents of these vehicles, which justifies the warrantless search, that's the intact.
I believe that's correct, and that is a matter of fact.
I'm sure that subjectively the police officer would love to find.
It is a matter of fact, and Judge Fitzwater made the finding that what Officer Trahan was doing was attempting to prepare an inventory. And if we look at the subset of...
If Officer Trahan said he thought he might have interrupted the search, and then he searched, so was he completing the search, and do we have one search by two officers, or do we have two different searches? Well, or in the mind of Trahan, he thought he was completing the initial search. So you look at what he thought, and he was looking at completing the inventory search, not doing a second inventory search.
I think that Officer Trahan said that once he became the impounding officer, he was responsible for what was in the car, and he conducted a search of the car. That search included some of the same area that where Detective Torres had begun his inventory, but then ceased. No testimony that he searched the back seat or the trunk or the glove box or anything like that. And I think that Judge Higginbotham had pointed to the Eighth Circuit's decision in Rowland, which I think superficially lends the most support to Mr. Shaw here. But once we really dive down into that case, we see two things. One, what we're dealing with here is the district court's factual finding of Officer Trahan's motivation, the purpose for the search. And we see also that the facts are very different. There was something more. One, there was a deviation. Deputies had only, when they impounded the vehicle, they only listed on the inventory sheet items that had potential evidentiary value. And it wasn't just the fact of a deviation, which the court, as Judge Higginbotham had pointed out, it wasn't just the fact of the deviation, because that didn't render the search invalid. Instead, it was, one, the nature of the deviation, the fact that they only inventoried potential evidence suggested that the officers in their mind, that's what they were looking for. But there was also more. There was the fact that they had called a drug detection dog to the scene, that they had admitted that part of the purpose of the search was for them to investigate narcotics trafficking, and they had repeatedly questioned Rowland about that. All of those things ultimately persuaded the Eighth Circuit that the district court was simply wrong when it said the inventory was not pretext. And although they didn't use the term clearly erroneous, I think that's what the court was doing, was saying the district court clearly erred in determining that that was an inventory search motivated by the policy and not pretext.
You want to understand the compelling reason for inventory searches, just look at the problems that lenders have who repossess automobiles. Because when they repossess an automobile, then they immediately get the claim that the family jewels were in the glove compartment, and all kinds of valuable things were in there, and then litigation goes on. And that is just a common fact and pattern of the world. So there's a real practical reason for these things.
Precisely. I think the district court made the factual finding that Officer Trahan was motivated to conduct an inventory here. That's what he was doing. That's what animated the search. That finding is not clearly erroneous, and for that reason, I would ask the court to affirm.
All right, thank you, sir. Mr. Beard.
Thank you. Judge Prado, with regard to the last question you'd ask about one search, two searches, page 160, Trahan makes evident and says he was doing a second look, a second search. So that is also the position that the district court took. There were two searches. Judge Fitzwater, with regard to inferences and what can be drawn, I would suggest that if the court is looking at inferences, it's equally plausible, if not more plausible, that that Officer Trahan's second search that went immediately to the area of the car where Trejo had said he thought there was a suspicious activity gives rise to the inference that he was in an investigatory mode. I'm not saying that you draw that at the district court.
What do you do with the fact that they had already offered the possession of the vehicle to one of the other passengers?
I don't think that's legally relevant in terms of whether the officer's behavior comported with the policy. I think it's of interest, but I don't think it's legally relevant or controlling. And if I can continue, Judge Jones, good faith, Leon, good faith. No, I think that this would be, I don't think it applies. I think that, in fact, if there were any consideration of this, it would be more akin to an error of law. In the court's cases say that when law enforcement makes a mistake of law, that actually would inure to our benefit. And I'm thinking the United States versus Miller, that was a case I was involved in, where the police mistakenly thought offense had been committed.
Well, obviously it hasn't been argued here, but I guess you would characterize it as a mistake about what inventory procedures permit.
Well, yes, and that would be analogous to the law.
That I don't agree with.
Well, then yes, my suggestion would be that the law, quote unquote, that those officers are also charged with following are their own procedures that the City of Dallas and the City of Dallas Police Department has given them. Those are the standardized procedures.
Well, what confused me about your argument was that in the summary of your brief, you talk about what the policy deviations are, and you say an officer purported to be another officer by signing another's name on an official form. A second search was conducted after an initial search. Detective Torres did not fill out a form, even after a highly valuable iPad in the car. And then, you know, the only thing you've argued here essentially is that there were two searches. So it seemed to me that you gave up on the technical deviations.
Well, the record is rife with examples of the deviations.
Is there any inventory search that? I mean, it's hard for me to envision an inventory search that you would find appropriate unless the car had been towed to some warehouse and then subjected to whatever the procedures were.
Well, of course, the my focus is on these two inventory searches, and I don't have a position in the abstract about other inventory searches.
Well, you said there were more of them now, so I suppose you get more cases.
Oh, well, there are. There are no searches incident to arrest. They're all inventory searches now for the reasons
that
Judge Higginbotham.
Well, that's because the law allows them, but.
Well, and I'm not suggesting that that's not an issue for another day, whether there's pretext or subterfuge. I would encourage the court to take a look at page 154, because this is where Officer Torres says, I'm not sure what the policy is. keeps you from doing as many searches are necessary. I'm not sure that it keeps you from doing as many searches are necessary to accomplish your goal. And that is exactly what he was doing, making sure that the vehicle was secure and there were no weapons or drugs or contraband. At 160, you, and that would be, I submit, in violation of the express procedures. Page 160, you have the second officer saying, I do a second look. That's also in violation. Either there is a requirement that they comply or there is not. Either, and if they have not, then it is either a substantial deviation or it is a minor deviation, if you will. This was substantial. It involved a second search.
I guess the inevitable discovery rule doesn't obtain with these either.
No, I don't think so, because, in fact, as the record evinces, Officer Trahan said that oftentimes things are left, in fact. This notion of perfect compliance, and I think you touched on it perhaps indirectly, that's a straw man. We've not suggested that there have to be perfect compliance. In fact, when I was speaking to your question, Judge Prado, there are deviations, but there are gross deviations. And this is a gross deviation. And for the reasons that we've suggested, we think the district court reversibly erred. And in particular, I think that its use of substituting reliance on training as opposed to adherence to policy is the legal error that committed that compels reversal. Thank you so much for your time.
All right. Thank you, sir. I want to welcome Judge Katharina Haynes's interns here. Normally, we would not have a large crowd for these arguments, but I gather there's a group of you. Judge Haynes said she sent you over to hear a different panel, so welcome, and here we are. Maybe. I hope you don't draw invidious comparisons.